Exclusively on CBS All Access, a legend returns.
I have a mission. There's not a hell of a chance for somebody to stop me.
Patrick Stewart in Star Trek Picard. Now streaming only on CBS All Access.
Well, it's almost Valentine's Day, and we have a little heart-to-heart gift for you with this fourth episode of our Star Trek Picard podcast, and of course, the fourth episode of Star Trek Picard, Absolute Candor.
We have a lot today. We have an awful lot, Dominic. Do you know how much we have today?
Tons. And we have not just guests, but special guests.
We have special guests, and we're going to talk about a lot. Not only is there a lot on the screen with this episode, there's a lot behind the scenes that's really fascinating. We have Jonathan Frakes, number one, is back this time in the director's chair instead of on the bridge. And of course, this episode is written by Michael Chabon, who's a showrunner and a Pulitzer Prize winner and O. Henry Prize winner. And he has done himself a credit with this show, I think. We're guests that we have today, Alex Kurtzman, who's the executive producer of Star Trek Picard, and also we have Kirsten Beyer, who is the co-creator of the show and supervising producer, and then we have something special a little later, don't we, Tom?
Yes, we do. We have, of course, let me stop. If you haven't seen the episode yet, the one that dropped about 14 hours ago on CBS All Access, I recommend you come back. But I don't think it's any spoiler to tell everyone that we know that Jerry Ryan is going to be part of Star Trek Picard, and Jerry Ryan, 7 of 9, is joining us later in today's podcast, along with Jonathan DeArco, who plays Hugh, who you've seen introduced in episode 3. We saw him the first time. They're going to be talking a little bit about their characters and their reintroduction to this Trekverse. But before that, let's talk to Alex and Kirsten.
You know, one of the things that's most fascinating to me about the Star Trek universe is you have the Federation and you have the Romulans, you have the neutral zone in between, and you of course have the Klingons. What they all represent. To me, the Vulcans worship logic, and in a way, the Romulans worship lies, or at least subterfuge. Do you think that...
The thing that was so great was the way Michael tried to get underneath all of that. Before we were even telling story, we were looking at the Romulans and going, how did they get this way? Mm. You know, how does a culture turn in on itself like that? And, you know, who hurt them? Mm. You know, and so we found an answer. And we built from there this mythology that ends up being so critical to the story we're telling.
And if you look at Michael's bookshelf, you know, the Yiddish Policeman's Union, I mean, it's all about a culture that's insulated and it's taken turns no one expects and has a secret history and things like
Michael
that.
Michael does secrecy well.
He really does. It's almost
we'll give him that.
Cultural Chinatown. Well. It's like, you know, trying to get to where, what's the mystery behind
you
all
Dennis
this?
Dennis Miller'd that one.
That's right.
Thank you very much.
But that is a, you know, part of this one, I feel like now that we're 4 episodes in, I can kind of speak frankly about where I feel this is at. And look, I'm partially with a fanboy hat on, but partially with an analytical hat on, is so a lot of this tale is starting to feel very poignant to the world we're living in. Mm-hmm. Very poignant. Like no longer nipping around the buds or around the edges of it or scraps from it. This is feeling like, oh, I've seen that in Syria, coming out of Syria. I've seen this now. Is that a worry as well as a direction?
It would only be a worry if it weren't so beautifully written by Michael. That's the truth. I think there's a lot of ways to make something that important feel really trivial with writing that's not as good. And the first draft that I read by Michael, which I almost don't want to tell you. I think he wrote in like 2 or 3 days. Was so...
You know, when people hear that, they hate him. They hate him. When you hear that, they're like, yeah, I locked myself in a hotel room for a weekend in Miami. Bang,
it's very annoying.
One Oscar later.
It's very annoying. But he's so good. And it was the draft brought tears to my eyes because it was so emotional and it was so sad. And
it's heartbreaking. Yeah. It's really heartbreaking because, you know, you mentioned it in a previous podcast about at one point, like, you guys realized as you were getting a few episodes in script-wise, like, we have to show the attack on Mars. Mm-hmm. Like, we have to show what happened here. Mm-hmm. And now it's like, we have to show the fallout. Mm. And the fallout is mega and meta, mm-hmm. personalized, obviously, with a protege who feels betrayed and a people who are displaced. It's a killer.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's the thing, is it is about the fallout. It is about this man who really did not... I mean, one thing we talk about, you know, as we were breaking story, it's like, what did he expect when he showed up? He clearly didn't expect that. Yeah. And when he gets there and he's sort of like, hi, everybody, and no one's paying attention to him anymore after the first time he landed there, everybody came running to him at his arrival. It's very sad. And, you know, obviously the saddest part is in his relationship with Elnor and how this boy really, it's Shane, right? He grew up and he, you know, come back and he didn't come back. But now he's back. And the idea that, you know, when we start talking about mythology, it really was Michael who came up with the idea of, the Romulan warrior sect, all women, never raised a boy before, the one boy who was raised by them. What is the logic behind that? Why? What is the Kwat Malat? What is it, you know, mythologies are also one of his great, great talents. Yeah. And when we were early in the process of breaking story, we would sort of have these kind of really broad conversations about like, well, what's the Kwat Malat mythology? And then he would come back the next day having written like 8 hours from 8 at night to, you know, whatever o'clock in the morning, and he would have pages and pages and pages of mythology.
Like the whole pantheon.
The whole pantheon. I mean, stuff that most people, it takes months, if not years, to think through, okay, what is the deep mythology here? Mm-hmm. And so by the time he was writing, a lot of that stuff had been worked out by him. And there's a beautiful tragedy to it. There's a real poignancy to Picard seeing it firsthand. There's the, you know, the, I think also the structure of the seeing the promise get made, then the promise get broken, then the consequences.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. Totally. And I think part of it too is, I think there, and I think this, I hate when people refer to actors as brave, because I always think, well, you get paid, you get that. I mean, it's like, I'm brave as digging a ditch in Chicago in the winter. But I do think that there is something about saying, and we've talked about this a little bit, about Patrick redressing the character, is, I'm just going to deconstruct this. Like, I'm going to turn this hero into almost a villain. I mean, ultimately, if you look at the responsibility of what happened, it is a villainous act. It is the, we walked away. We saw the trains leaving and went, you know what? Those kids will be fine. We're not going to, they're sending them to some camp. They'll be fine, right? We'll walk away because we have to deal with this other thing. And now you come back and one of those children is saying, it wasn't fine. Wasn't fine at all. There was no fine in this at all. And he has to hold that. You're not a hero. You're any sense of who you think you are, you still don't get it. Raffi told you, Chris has kind of mocked you, like, you know, but you just don't get it yet, do you, old man? Mm-hmm. And that's hard. And then you see an actor do that. And he's like, yeah, I have to play that guy. I have to play the guy you thought you loved. You don't love him so much anymore.
Yeah, Patrick, it wasn't that he had to. He wanted to. Mm-hmm. That was the challenge he threw down to us, and that he then so fully embraced in this. That's, he wanted to show us sides of this character that otherwise we would never get to see.
And that's his Shakespearean facets, probably. I mean, his extensive Shakespearean heritage, you know, kind of comes across in the dynamics. This is not a very good comparison, because Picard hasn't done the things this other person has, but if you look at how people were viewed in one day and how they would be viewed if they went back. You think about like Giuliani going back to like ground zero today, like walking around, and it would be a very different response than it was on September 11th or 12th, mm-hmm. you know, in 2001. It's interesting that people who are defining an era, one of the things that happens is the eras change in the past, and that person's still attached to that previous era.
And also perspective changes, you know, like the notion of what that was. You know,
yeah,
There are people who look at the Second World War and they think of FDR as holding down the fort and then getting ready. And then there are people who say, like, he knew what was going to happen at Pearl Harbor. Or they knew the, you know, don't say that people didn't know about the camps. People were writing about the camps in 1937. Don't act like it wasn't known, you know?
The thing that's beautiful is that Picard, I mean, and this is where we begin deconstructing the character in order to build him up again. But Picard, He took a morally righteous stance. He said, well, if we're not going to live by the ideals of the Federation, then I'm going to pull out altogether. But what he didn't do was then say, okay, and then when I step away and the Federation does its thing, there's going to be so much damage.
But also, too, is you. But I also think, too, is you took another again. I say it's the mega and the meta, right? Mm-hmm. There's another sandwich. It's like he had a temper tantrum.
He did.
You know, a loyal soldier mm-hmm. of the Federation just didn't like the orders he got, and right. so he decided, yeah, I know, I don't have to listen anymore. I'm the man. It's like, no, you're not. Like, we all have to listen. That's how it works. If you signed up and took that oath, that's how it works. You might not want to take that hill, but we've ordered you to take that hill.
But the legacy of Kobayashi Maru is that you
always find a way.
You make the change of rules.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But that's it. But he, in this sense, the way we are, where we are now, in four, and him face to face, which is rare that one has to do that, is like, oh, this isn't like someone wrote a book and told me what happened. They're like, no, that boy's standing there.
But this is where the story pivots from being this is where it pivots to becoming a redemption story, because it really isn't until he sees the consequences of the choice that he understands that he has to redeem himself.
Yeah, well, it's the hero's journey has now begun.
Yeah, and he's now on the path of not just being humbled, but recognizing, I can't stop until I make this right. I've been living on my vineyard, pretending everything's fine, convincing myself everything's fine, but people have really suffered, and I cannot go towards the end of my life knowing that I played a part in that.
But here's something I'll tell you that I find nice about this. Nice, maybe not the word I want to use, but is all that happens, and then they get back on the ship, and he snaps at Eleanor. Yeah. He's still like, hey, I'm still the man. Yes. Like, oh, you're not going to do that. I order you. You can only do this under these circumstances in the future. You will not fight like that. He still can't quite realize that not everyone snaps to attention when he's in the room, and that his word is the last word. And I mean, clearly the series is called Picard, so his word is the last word, but you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Well, I mean, he's got to earn the respect that was just granted to him by his position when he's the captain of a starship. And he's got to earn it on an individual basis, time again, from each of these folks. I do think, though, also there's an element of Picard recognizing in Elnor that he is a wild creature. And he is absolutely deadly. You know, when somebody crosses a Guatemalat, there is no doubt of what the result will be. So as much as it might be a control issue, I also think it's an issue of
can't just
security.
Go around killing everybody.
Yeah, yeah, right. That's not who we are. That's not who he is ever going to be.
Right.
He's still
meta and I think at an emotional level, when you talk about meta, and he becomes the father again. He steps back into that role when he says that. You know, I think he was the father when he was little.
Yeah.
Right, when he's reading to him and when he's fencing with him. Yeah. But he becomes the father again at that point. And I think, so in a weird way, it's satisfying, even though it's also complicated.
Well, and that's, I think, the big part of it, which is, and I think we've seen that in these first four episodes, is maybe banal to say, but there's no easy answers here. Beam me up. Correct. You know, like this is playing itself out. Mm-hmm. To that, interesting choice for director here, my friend. I mean, can we talk about
it? Sure.
I mean, Jonathan Frakes, he directs this. There's so much loaded in there. I just we want to know all the gossipy details. Like, we just want to know the whole deal.
Well,
because the two of them together. I mean, I just like the teacher, but the pupil becomes the master. Like, there's a million cliches I can throw out.
Sure. The first thing that is lovely to know is that they had such a great time. Like, you could tell that Patrick was just so happy to have his old friend there. And even though they weren't acting in scenes together, which brought another kind of happiness when they finally were, to be able to just be back on that familiar ground was, I think, really gratifying for both of them. Jonathan's directed Discovery for us, so it wasn't like...
I mean, he's a veteran.
He's a veteran. Yeah,
he segued into that a long time ago. But
in the films, too.
Yeah.
But it just, I feel like this one, though, it's kind of like, you know, it's like De Niro saying, hey, Al, can you, like, you know, go knock the telephone case? So, like, you know, it's like, what? You're the kid who was like, you know, it's different. Mm-hmm.
I think also Jonathan is such an emotional creature, you know, like he's such a sweet creature. And in a story that's a father-son story, to have the kind of father-son dynamic, if you could really even call it that, between the director and the star was also quite lovely.
It's interesting.
That's very Art of War, my friend.
It really is. It really is. You know, and Jonathan is such a wonderfully warm guy. Mm-hmm. And I remember talking to him last year, and I mentioned that in a way, you know, he came to Star Trek, he wasn't a fan, you know, growing up. He was aware of it, but he wasn't immersed in it by any means. And other members of the Next Generation cast were. And then for him to step out and become a director of film and TV with the franchise, I asked him if there was any parallels to your path, Alex, because you know you didn't grow up as a big Star Trek fan, and you came in through the film, and now you find yourself in this you know this guardian role, and he absolutely seized on that. He really he's like, absolutely, he sees in you a kindred spirit as far as the arc of your Federation time
connection. I feel it deeply with him as well, and I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that. And, you know, it's funny, Nick Meyer is the same.
Yeah, because he...
Nick Meyer is very much the same. It was not his... Star Trek was not really his thing. But I, in a funny way, if you listen and you surround yourself with enough people who will tell you, no, that you really can't break that rule.
Right.
The objectivity that comes from liking it, not loving it, allows you to love it in a different way later you actually start to really go there.
Yeah.
And... I feel comfort with Jonathan. I feel like, you know, he innately understands the rules of Star Trek and where the line is. And I think he also understands that I'm looking to push it as much as it can be pushed in a new context.
Nobody knows scripture like a convert.
Exactly. You know? I think that's very well said.
I just made it up.
Well, that's very well said.
Well, it's true. That's going to be on a t-shirt next week.
To speak of that, though, to speak of kind of bringing people we know at the end of this, we all knew she was coming because she was at San Diego. We revealed that, like, she's been at San Diego. She's been around. But Jerry Ryan shows up as Seven of Nine. And I think I felt like it was a jaw dropper. I felt like, oh, here we go. Like, the cavalry's arrived. Like, and I, you know, that's a terrible cliche because the cavalry arriving is built in the ugly parts of American mythology as well. But for the good part of it, it's like, someone has come who is going to be there with him. Like, Raffi is his loyal companion, but Seven of Nine is, there's so many complexities there, and it's Jerry showing up, and it's this thing. How was that in the introduction to this, of bringing her in? Because you guys, I mean, you know, it was out there. You guys didn't hide it. You know, it wasn't like, oh my God, here she comes. Mm-hmm. Was it what? 7 months ago, you told the world she was coming?
Mm-hmm.
Seven or nine.
God. Almost better. Almost better.
Go sit in the corner.
Yeah, exactly. Make your little t-shirts on Etsy.
Think about what you just did.
I'm sorry.
You want to take this one?
How long did we, like... So the great thing about Seven in terms of Picard, right, is that these are two people who have had this experience that is otherwise fairly unique. Hugh is along with us as well, but in terms of going deep, being humans, being assimilated, having that restored to you, Seven becomes this perfect foil character for Picard. And yet, the reality is they've never met each other. And we were so excited when we sort of realized how you could play with that and dig in. These are people who are sort of famous in their own way, certainly would know of each other, but have no real relationship. And watching them create a relationship before our eyes.
And also, what is that, you know, what is that shared trauma in that it doesn't necessarily make you want to be close with that person? It's a little like staring into the sun. It's almost too painful because that they've shared that, you know, and that I think was very interesting to us, that they're very different, you know, like Elnor. Seven, well, I guess I don't want to ruin some stuff that's coming in Five, but she has beef with him for the choices that he's made.
I don't think you're spoiling anything to, I mean, that's clear on it. It's going to happen. Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of it is because she's now left to clean up the galaxy because he bailed out.
Yeah.
And she, in a funny way, like, she's the one who, you know, upheld the principles, even though he sat there with his principles in his vineyard.
Exactly.
You know?
I mean, she's the superhero. Right. And super, being a superhero is messy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, aka Batman, I guess, is a good example, or Spider-Man in many ways.
Well, in an interesting way, you know, in the opposite of Batman, you know, Batman is rich and has a limitless supply of money, and she does not. So, you know, she's a little bit like
Rorschach.
Yeah, she's Rorschach, or she's the cowboy with the horse who doesn't really have anything as he travels from town to town and tries to just get enough to keep going, you know, while doing the right thing in the town. And that's Seven's a cowboy.
At this point, I think it's also fair that we should talk about is clearly the show's called Picard, so there's a focus to it, but tremendous amount of strong female characters.
Mm-hmm.
Tremendous, you know, if there was a word like co-leads could mm-hmm. be developed, I think at this point mm-hmm. we're now at the place where we can say that.
Mm-hmm.
Allison and Michelle and now Jerry and I feel like that's very telling of where you guys see this show and how you see it working, both as a show and in 2020 in this industry.
I think not just the show. I think this whole Star Trek universe. It's same on Discovery. You'll see the same on Section 31. We're taking what Roddenberry did first, and we're doubling, tripling, quadrupling down on it. You'll never see a Star Trek show that we're associated with that doesn't have that, as long as we're doing it.
It's interesting, too, because Seven and Picard, one of the things that occurs to me is they may have different views of things, but they are the only people that know what the sound of digital information sounds like when it's
right.
coming through your headpiece
yeah.
and you're part of this huge thing. I mean, they know the poetry of binary language in a way that we don't.
And they know the PTSD of it as well.
Yes.
You know,
that's most importantly.
Yeah. They could have a conversation that no one else in the universe could have.
That's yeah. right.
And Picard actually very much needs to have that conversation, and he mm-hmm. doesn't know it until they're together.
So to kind of wrap up today's podcast, we're now at episode 4. 7 of 9 has shown up. We now have a sense of the stakes. We now have a sense of the geopoetic as well as the geopolitical for intergalactic political of this almost halfway through the season. Where are we going?
That's like a spoiler question.
That way.
Yeah. Well, I think Picard has only begun to understand the ripple effects of his choices. And there's a lot more going on with a lot of the characters than you are initially presented with. A lot more. And part of what I think is beautiful about the streaming model now, and I guess Damon is really responsible for starting this in Lost, because that's the first show that I remember being able to go down many different tributaries. And that was obviously a network show where it had, you know, when you were following by the end 3,000 characters, but you could say like, this episode, we're just going to focus on this character. This episode, we're focusing. And I feel like what begins to happen in the narrative is that while it always remains Picard's story, you're going to begin going down tributaries with other characters and learning a lot more about them, where, you know, the next episode in episode 5 is going to tell you a lot more about 7, you know, because obviously she just showed up at the end of 4. You're going to learn a lot more about Rios. You're going to learn a lot more about Allison. You're going to learn that maybe they all have different reasons for going on this trip than what they presented. You know, some of them may have secrets. And we're going to begin to understand more about what it means for Soji to be the quote-unquote destroyer. And, you know, the other thing that I was honestly really nervous about in the structure as we were breaking the spine of the season was the idea that it was going to take some significant time for Picard to get to the other character, to get to Soji. And could you run 2 trains simultaneously?
Did you worry about peaking too early, conversely?
I worried that people would lose interest at a certain point and be like, all right, I want them to be together. And the truth is, I'm not going to tell you if they end up together, but hopefully the stories were interesting enough that they ran in parallel in a way that was revealing, that was intriguing, rather than sort of stally.
Yeah, well, I think by the nature of the subject matter, I think that it's just a more interesting way of telling a story.
I agree.
I mean, it's you know, you're not planting one tree and saying, I have a forest. There's a lot of seeds out there.
And the characters themselves are also interesting, that I think you'd feel really shortchanged if they were just background players.
Yeah.
You know, like everyone has real motivation and real depth and dimension. And hopefully you fall in love with everybody and you want to be spending time.
And also, I think too, to distinguish yourself from you know, Next Gen and the movies and other things, is you don't want to make this Picard's lesson of the week. Oh,
God, no.
Abandoning a people to die near genocide and become refugees in the galaxy.
bad. Mm-hmm. Abandoning my friends and hoping that they'll still work for me even though I've done nothing to help them. Bad.
Well, that's where it would become this kind of overly simplified, trivialized version of what this is. And we don't settle long enough. Once that's made clear to him, there's not any reason to keep reiterating it.
Yeah. It's fascinating. And also with two trains, it's always interesting because they're on the same track. So like,
right,
you know,
right.
It's not like your train's going in different
directions.
You're
waiting for them to collide.
Always waiting for them to collide.
Yeah,
exactly. And now, as promised, we go into extra coverage here. We have our second half. We have Jerry Ryan. And we have Jonathan Del Arco, two Star Trek familiars who are back in the universe.
That pilot's hailing us, JL.
Open a channel.
Open the channel, put him on.
He's asking permission to beam over. His ship's breaking up.
Nah, too risky.
His shields are failing.
Ravi, beam him in directly here.
Do it.
Hello.
Got him.
Seven of nine.
You owe me a ship, Picard.
You guys go back, right? You guys are friends, and that must be nice to return the Federation space together.
It really is. It's
to the extent
fun.
That we did,
and
right?
Very surreal.
Yeah.
How so surreal?
I mean, I said goodbye to this character 20 years ago, and you more than that. So
yeah.
I really thought I was telling her goodbye. That was it. I didn't envision a scenario where I'd ever come back and do her again, and it's kind of amazing, and to be able to do it with my friends.
I know.
Is that, though, are there parts of that, and, you know, we've talked to Sir Patrick about this and others involved in the show, is returning, you come with some of the baggage of the character and some of your own of like, yeah, I did let this go. I mean, for lack of a better expression, we got divorced 20 years ago. Now we're back. How is that from a, maybe I can only think of a NASA term, how is that in terms of reentry?
I mean, it's actually kind of, looking back at what we did, the distance of time is super beneficial because there are chapters that have not been written about both of our characters. No one has seen or known what we've been through. So to some degree, we had to make a lot of that up because, you know, there's no canon story. There's books that touch on our lives, but what works for you as an actor, not what works in a book. You gotta find things that work for you to deliver the material. And, fresh, you know?
And how was that for you guys? You know, I mean, I know that one thing for Alex is it's very important for him to talk, to respect the canon, but not to be held hostage to it. And at the same time, to respect the actors, to respect, you know, I know, for instance, you know, we've talked about it. The Patrick was a part of the writer's room and stuff like that. To say like, hey, look, you know this character better than anybody else.
Right.
So how much of that was this for you guys? I mean, you show up last week in episode three. You drop in on us like what, scant seconds before
right,
the end? I mean,
right.
Like, and we're going to talk all about more of what happens next week in five and what have you. And hopefully, Jerry will be able to join us for some of that. But give us a sense about that in terms of, like, as you said, like the backstory, the re-educating of that character.
Well, we had concerns only because we none of us really had scripts.
About that laugh.
We all said, well, because
concerns
we had
massive letters in the sky.
We had a Dark Night of the Soul.
I'll be more blunt about it.
Dark Night of the Soul.
Really scary.
Why?
Because any character that you readdress 20 years on, I mean, it's going to be, to an extent, unnerving to go back to it. But in a situation specifically like this, with a fandom that is so passionate and so loyal and so knowledgeable about every detail, you don't want to screw it up.
They can be unforgiving, too.
Well, they can be unforgiving.
Unforgiving. They'll find out where I live.
They're so loyal and passionate to this franchise. Yeah. You don't want to disappoint them. You don't want to screw it up for them.
Yeah.
Not just that they'll be pissed, but you owe it to them to do these characters that have become iconic to them justice.
But so when you come back as Seven of Nine, mm-hmm. How do you inform that? Because that, you know, those are real concerns. That's not like, listen, I need my trailer to be this big. Like, that's like, I'm putting my face out there for this, and I'm the one who falls if this falls, and I'm the one who soars if this soars.
Absolutely.
So how did you do that coming into this with Alex and the gang and with Patrick and finding it and with Jonathan?
Johnny saved me.
Really?
We actors are a community of self-helpers, and like I kept saying to her, I just had a week on the show. Do you want me to come over and run lines with you? And she's like, no, I can't. But we figured it out, you know?
No, Johnny, no, he's underplaying this. He saved my ass. Totally. Because I was panicking when I finally saw the first script. And I know for this character specifically, well, yours too. I mean, I had 4 years of playing a character that was very specific, and she went from being full Borg to being, you know, mostly human, but there was a lot of transition, but she was still pretty stylized and specific at the end of that 4 years. This is 20 years later, and when I saw the first script...
Which Michael wrote, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not knowing a lot of... We're really not knowing any of the backstory yet, because I hadn't talked to anybody when I finally got the script in any detail. I panicked because I couldn't find her voice. I couldn't hear her in any of this dialogue because it was so different. Her voice was so specific for those 4 years, partly because of the character, the way it was written and developed, but partly also because Brannon Braga wrote or rewrote most of Seven's dialogue over that 4 year period. Not every line, but a lot of it. So it was a very specific voice. And this was so different, so much more casual and human and slangy and not Seven to me. And I panicked.
So was it the cadence or the content?
Everything. Yeah. I just panicked. And I think because I can't really tell you exactly what he told me, but I just needed something.
You can tell
actor.
Us exactly what he told you. Yeah, we're good with that. Yeah.
But no, I can't because the story. It'll give away... Well, not really. Point. Maybe you actually do know at this
not
point.
Not really. I just said to her, well, we sat around, we read it over and over again, and she was getting up and cooking. She was cooking lunch. She kept cooking. I'm fucked. Yeah. I was like, I'm totally fucked. I'm like, let's calm down. And she's like, she's too human. And I'm like, what if, just try this.
This was like 2 hours into
I was
this,
like,
by
just
the
try
way.
This. Pretend she's pretending to be more human. Just to fit in.
Yeah, he said, what if she makes a conscious choice to be as human as possible?
And she did it. She's like,
and
it was
that's
that
what
easy.
I needed. It was just, and I think I was just so panicked that I couldn't see
now,
past
that sounds to me like the sort of thing that only a friend,
right?
Especially because you're walking around with a knife, and a fellow actor could say,
and he's also a phenomenal director.
And hear that in a sense.
Yeah. And I had just gone.
And that's what I needed. I needed that. To grab onto as an actor to make it make sense, and then
I just had gone through it because we all know I come before you, so the previous episode
you joined us last week,
exactly. So I you know, I had to figure that out on my own, you know, earlier on in the process, and I didn't choose that way to go. I chose other things to get me there, but you know, we have our bag of tricks as actors to get us to a place where we feel comfortable to just be able to do. You could have done it without that note. It just, you couldn't mentally get there.
I was so panicked. I think I just couldn't get past the panic.
But let's talk a little bit about that in terms of the return of Hugh.
Yeah.
So, I mean, your process was clearly a different one.
Yeah.
But what was that process? And what was it within the framework of clearly where this has gone,
right,
episodes 1 and 2, and where it's going?
So they were pretty hands off in terms of telling me how to play the part. We were trying to figure out who he had become. Last time you saw me, I was pretty robotic. I was still fully, you know, with Borg implants and all that. So the costume I wore on Next Gen was physically restricting, so it created a lot of that sort of robotic movement on its own. I didn't have that here. And so I tried a bunch of things, and then I decided that I went back and looked at Iborg, and I found a couple of physical things that he did that informed, you know, who he would be physically for me. And then I just latched on to the emotional life of where he is now and invested myself personally in that and kind of let go of the notion that I had to be seamless, because 20 years have passed. People change in a year, much less in 20. So allowing all that to kind of happen. And then actually, it wasn't until I was on set that first day that it clicked. And I was like, thank God he showed up. You know, it was like I was on set and he showed up and I, you know, we were shooting and I was like, oh my God, this is who he is now. This is amazing. Great. Don't get in his way. Just let it happen. But the sets were so, the sets and the art design and the costumes and the makeup made it kind of easy to kind of walk that world. And you're an actor, you could give yourself to that. And it was super fun. I mean, it was very immersive, you know.
It's fascinating what the Borg represent and what they've always represented in the stories and in the saga. Do you think what they represent has changed this time? Do you find more complexity in the threat and the nature of it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, I mean, it's a whole new world. It's going to flip the tables on a lot of, and you know, Iborg and Jerry's character did that already in the canon because we were not threats, but there are a ton of complexities. There are a ton of table flipping on who's enemy, who's not in the world that we're in. And that's kind of really fun to play. You know,
we talked about this when we were at Comic-Con with you guys in San Diego last summer, but I wanted to really get a sense from you guys. You know, Jonathan, you show up in episode 3, mm-hmm. and Jerry, you show up at the end of 4, but everyone's known that you guys are coming. It's been well publicized when mm-hmm. you guys, from the moment you stepped on stage in Hall H, that this was going to happen, and hugely anticipated, clearly. What has it been like from the other end for you guys? Because there is always this period between when the world discovers something, and then there's the press tour, and then this, and then that. And now, you know, it was on January 23rd, the show finally debuted, and now you guys come in as weeks go by.
Yeah.
What is that time? It's like, you're like dual Captain Americas in suspended animation. Yeah. Like, you are in the Star Trek ice.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like. Yeah. I mean, it's been weird. It seems like it's been forever.
Yeah, it has been forever.
So it's surreal.
Since we've known we were doing the show, it's been really forever.
Well, yeah. Yeah, because we were approached well over a year ago when we first heard about the possibility of this happening.
I had an interesting, like, I went to do ADR, which is when you loop over your lines you may not have said or that got messed up. And it was a really big scene I was looping, and I saw it. I was like, okay, this is great. And now this is my last moment of doing any of this for this season. And I got home and I was like, okay, now it's time to let it go because it's out of my hands. The choices are made. It's going to be on screen. People are going to respond one way or another. So let it go and have fun at the parties.
So once again, we thank you so much for joining us. We know that you Picard fans, you know, you want to know as much about what's going on with the show on screen and off screen. And we hope that we are doing you a service, fan service and otherwise. As always, want to thank our amazing guests, especially Jerry and Jonathan, for showing up for a special treat today. And that is, well, we're almost halfway through the season. I guess next week is episode 5.
And it really is engaging, isn't it?
Well, you just went there too. I mean, we should have a drinking game of how many times you can say engage, because now that Patrick said at the end of episode 3, it's kind of a free-for-all.
Get the Romulan ale. It's time.
All right. Well, please join us next week on our Star Trek Picard podcast that always drops at 2 p.m. Pacific time, about 14 hours after Picard's, the latest episode, drops on CBS All Access. We are primed and ready to go.